Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I hope you had a great Christmas, however quiet, if it was anything like mine, very quiet. And I would so wish the sun would shine, don't you? I'm so fed up with this weather. But anyways, maybe it will pick up at some point. So I thought that what would be really good, as we're at the end of a year, rather than bring in a completely new guest, is just look back over just a few of our clips from last year. I thought that might be quite nice. It's really good to actually look back and remember some of the people that I've interviewed and some of their little nuggets of wisdom. And of course, we can't include many, so it's a fairly random selection. But I thought you might enjoy hearing some of these clips. And if you haven't heard lots of the podcasts, then hopefully it will inspire you to go back and check out some of the archives, of which hundreds now, literally hundreds. Just before we get into that, I did see that piece in the press this week saying there was a survey done, said that just over half of those who planned to reduce their alcohol consumption once the coronavirus restrictions were lifted in the UK. I think they're talking about in the summer, when restrictions were lifted in the summer, apparently an awful lot of people vowed that they would drink less, but only half managed to do that by December. The survey says one in five adults reported drinking more during the pandemic. It was a drink aware survey, and they found that 17% of those surveyed said they would cut down on alcohol when the lockdown ended. But in December, several months after the vast majority of restrictions were scrapped, 46% of those had stuck to their plan, is what they found. I must admit, I'm surprised it was as high as that, really. I think, with the amount of stress we've all had over the last couple of years, I think it's really tough for people, particularly if they don't have the support and the connection that they need. But of course, we're going into a period where lots of people are now saying, OK, it's time. I can do Dry January. Dry January, of course, is brilliant for making things feel at least socially it's easier, because everyone doesn't need to do that sober shaming thing, because why would you not be doing Dry January? So, it's as good a time as any to kickstart it. Of course, I was, you might have seen on social media, I've just celebrated my 4 years sober. Very proud of myself. And also that's what I did effectively. In my case, it just so happened to be December, the end of December. But I can't deny it made it easier when I went to sort of functions and various things. The fact that, perhaps the bar had a little bit more on offer because it was Dry January. So, absolutely. What I'm trying to say is, if you've been thinking about it and you know that now is the time, absolutely go for it. Embrace it, whatever, has been going on previously. It doesn't matter if it's your 10th time round the block at trying to do this. It doesn't matter. Just make this your last day one. But you know that what I'm going to say is, if you are doing Dry January, if you are starting today, and you really want to commit to this, then the way to do that is to focus 100% on what you are gaining, and do not give a thought to what you're giving up. You're not giving anything up. Just focus on what you're gaining and put masses of effort into that. Really focus on that. Focus on great food, focus on self-care stuff, focus on what you can do with your time, because you will have extra time. Focus on getting your head together, focus on looking within. And, I can't deny it won't be tough. It might be tough for a few days, for God's sake. If you've been drinking for years, it could easily be tough for the whole month. That's why, that's the only way that Dry January falls down, really, because often it takes more than a month to really, really feel the benefits kicking in. Do it as soon as you're listening to this. You don't wait till January the 1st if you're listening to this before today. And just go for it. There's so much support. I'm going to say check out the Sober Club, because, the connection there is absolutely amazing. And trust me, if I can be sober for 4 years, so can you. My only regret is that I didn't do this sooner. That is the only regret. Now, as you know, we have got an event on Zoom on Sunday. I think there may be a few tickets left for our online session. But what we're really going to do, and everyone can do this for themselves too, is just reflect upon, you know, what we want to say goodbye to, what we want to release from last year. I mean, it's been a challenging year, I think probably for everyone, it's fair to say. But for all of that, you will have had your own successes, and you know, there'll be an awful lot that you can be grateful for. So we're going to look at what we can release, but also look at what we can be grateful for, and absolutely pat yourself on the back. You know, years ago, I would never have put a post like the one I did on social media, kind of bigging myself up as I did yesterday for my soberversary. But hell, why not? You know, we do absolutely have to acknowledge you know, ourselves sometimes. So we're going to look at that. And then we're also obviously going to look to what we want moving forward. And I think most of us know that New Year's resolutions per se do not work very well. We set ourselves up to fail. We do this resolving to be different thing. Well, why would we want to be different? Surely we just want to be who we really are. We want to come back to our own authentic self, which, as you well know, I don't believe is possible when you're still drinking. But let's assume that you are going to stop, or you have stopped. Then I really do think you can ditch the New Year's resolutions, but instead set some intentions. Focus on what it is you really want. Make it manageable. You know, you can dream big, but make it manageable. So really focus on what it is you would like for this coming year and how you can actually make that work. And that takes a little bit of, you know, insight. You really need to use a little bit of insight into what it is you're going to want to do. I also think it's nice to join together and really raise that kind of collective consciousness. I love that quote, "The future is not planned, it's imagined." So we're going to spend some time together imagining the future. And if you can't join us for that session, then just do some stuff yourself, of course. Just take a little bit of time to just reflect and visualize what it is you want for the future. So that's a good way to lead in to my first clip, just doing a little bit of a look back at last year. In the Sober Club, we do an awful lot of woo-woo, basically, some people would call it. And what I mean by that is, of course, we have an online course, Get the Buzz Without the Booze. We do an awful lot around cravings, around nutrition, around fitness, around mindset, you know, and how we can choose our thoughts. But in addition, I love bringing in lots of other odds and sods, really. So we have an angel expert does stuff for us sometimes. We had a session on numerology. We've done stuff on essential oils and seasonal living, and of course lots of meditations, hypnosis sessions. We've done EFT tapping, and obviously NLP. So, you know, some people would call this stuff woo woo. You know, whether you do or you don't is up for grabs. But the point is, I love sharing and exposing people to some of these wonderful things. And of course, you like some of it, you may not like others. We did a fabulous session as well with Shaman Yakov Darling Khan, which was a movement medicine session, basically shaking it out. And wow, has that proved useful to many a member who's feeling stressed. There's not much can beat actually just putting that track on, that drumming track, and just releasing your anxiety. Anyways, to kind of correlate all of that, I thought, who better to invite onto the podcast than Dr. David Hamilton? I've known David for absolutely years. We're both Hay House authors. And David, of course, started off by writing Why Kindness is Good for You and a whole bunch of other books. So the perfect guest for the podcast. So before we get into the book, just give us a little bit of your kind of potted history for anyone who hasn't come across your work.
Yeah, I worked as an R&D scientist in a really big pharmaceutical company, really building drugs for heart disease and cancer. I say building drugs, I was what you call an organic chemist, which is like an adult who plays Lego. But instead of using, you know, plastic building blocks to assemble a variety of shapes, you use atomic building blocks. But the idea is the same. It's like Lego. And I used to literally build atomically what became, you know, heart medicines and cancer medicines. But I really was more intrigued by the placebo effect. And I started to study it in my spare time when I worked in the industry. At the time, you know, this was, you know, I started working in the pharmaceutical industry in the late 90s, and the mind-body connection was not understood very well at all.
Yeah.
And so when I started to suggest to my colleagues that there could be some mind-body connection that explained the placebo effect, you know, they used to laugh, call it quackery. I mean, not unkindly, we were all just friends, you know, but you know the way friends banter, oh, it's all quackery, and all that kind of stuff, because nobody understood it. So we just assumed, and this is actually a common theme through all perception of woo-woo. We just assumed, you know, that, or my colleagues assumed that people who responded to placebo were just going to get better anyway. But I began to research it and realize that there was actually something going on. And it turned out even then, there was lots of available science.
Yeah.
But we just didn't know that. And I find, and one of my motivations behind the book is, so many people refer to things as woo-woo, sometimes even pseudoscience, not because they're speaking from a position of knowledge and authority, and they can rightly say, oh, that's woo-woo or pseudoscience. Most of the time you find it's because they're not experts at all, and actually really don't know that there is available science and there is available philosophical thought. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to the best of my ability, pull a lot of that together and at least give people who do practice these kind of things a wee bit of, you know, backing to say there is a lot of stuff there. And for people who are skeptical, to say, look, before you be skeptical, at least look at some of the data and you'll see that maybe, you know, we shouldn't really be calling these things woo-woo after all, because the definition of woo-woo really is unconventional beliefs regarding as having little or no scientific data.
Exactly. It's very derogatory, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very derogatory.
Yeah. And I mean, we're also used to being, you know, sort of laughed at and being called woo-woo. But as you say, there is so much science, you know, behind all of this stuff. So where did you kind of start when you were thinking about the book, about what you would include, about, you know, I mean, were there aspects of this that came as a bit of a surprise to you when you actually did a bit more digging deep?
Yeah, I mean, I started in what I call the lower end of woo-woo.
Yeah.
I go from the lower end to the high end.
You know, go on then, give us a benchmark.
You know,
because I'm probably at all ends.
Yeah, well, me too, actually.
Or at least I have been there over the years. Let's put it that way.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. I kind of flip between all three. But, you know, the lower end, I call it things like, you know, the impact of thoughts and emotions on your brain, on your physiology, you know, placebo effect, meditation, even things like how emotions can, you know, trapped emotion can have an impact by almost storing up charge in the nervous system in the context of trauma, kind of lower end of woo-woo, meaning at least some people are aware that there probably is research, even though most people don't know about it. So I gathered a lot of that. Then moving into things like Reiki and crystals, I call the kind of mid-range and the idea that perception shapes reality and show that there's a heck of a lot of science available, either trial data or at least show why these things might work for us. Moving into the higher end, you know, like psi, ESP, telepathy, prayer, all that kind of stuff, even law of attraction, and sketched a whole basis of science. To answer your question, what was most surprising to me was just how much science there was that could explain how crystals work.
Ah, interesting.
That was, for me, the most surprising, in fact, so much so that it's the biggest chapter. I had to take out about three, it was too long, and you can't have a chapter that takes longer than an hour to read for audiobooks, otherwise Audible and other things, they just snap it over into two chapters and it spoils the flow.
Right.
So you're really limited in the number of words. So I literally had to chop off
So tell us, give us a bit more detail on that then. What should we be looking for crystals? What can we all benefit from with crystals?
In terms of crystals, there's actually three different ways. Now, first of all, there isn't any scientific studies on crystals because, to be honest, most academics wouldn't touch the subject anyway. That doesn't mean that there's nothing there. They just probably wouldn't touch it for the sake of their careers. I know what that's like. There's certain subjects I would have avoided in the past as well for the sake of people, you know, almost ridiculing. But what there is, though, is lots of research that would suggest why they might work for us. Let me give you an example of where I'm coming from. So in the Buddhist teaching of Dzogchen, D-Z-O-G-C-H-N, Dzogchen, they often use a clear crystal. The teachers use a clear crystal.
Like a quartz crystal.
Like a clear quartz. Yeah. So this is a citrine I've got here, but a clear quartz. Now, what the clarity of the quartz does is it serves as what's called a mental representation. Now, in cognitive psychology, that's a really well-known area of research. So by mental representation, what I mean is that the teachers of Dzogchen use that as a focal point for the practitioners, and it gives them something to focus on because the clarity of the crystal represents to them the clarity and the clear state of mind and being
right. That
one wishes to attain.
Yeah,
so it becomes a focal point, something to focus on. So the moment by holding the crystal, even by having it in your visual field, and you see the clarity of it, your mind becomes less muddled and fuddy because you keep looking at it and seeing it, and that reminds you, oh, I have to attain a clear state of being. So it's like a constant reminder. Now, common sense tells you having a constant reminder of a goal is going to help you achieve that goal.
I was lucky enough last year too to interview the wonderful Catherine Gray. Now, I've interviewed her a couple of times before for The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober. That was one of my first podcast interviews, actually. And for The Unexpected Joy of Being Single. She also came into Steve Wright in the Afternoon, of course, on Radio 2. And now her latest book is Sunshine, Warm, Sober. And we had such a great chat. I can only play you a really tiny bit, but do go back and listen to that interview, because in that book, there's an awful lot about, you know, kind of research into various things that we thought we knew. And we chatted about all kinds of stuff as well, about what life is like when you're a little further on into sobriety. You know, we had a really interesting chat about boundaries, around setting boundaries for ourselves, which usually when we're drinking, it's something we're not very good at. And we also talked personalities.
Tell us about the addictive personality thing then. Does such a thing exist?
Yeah, so it looks like that's a myth. I asked, so for the book, I took loads of these burning questions that are just debated everywhere on comments boards from here to Timbuktu. And they get people very irate and very sure that their answer is the right answer. Things like, you know, like we just discussed, the labels addict and alcoholic, whether they aid recovery or hinder it. Also, you know, is addiction a disease?
Yeah.
Is it hereditary? Things like that. And the addictive personality was one of them. And I already knew, I think I first came across the concept of it being a myth in Annie Grace's This Naked Mind book. And I found that really interesting because, again, it was just something that I'd always been taught. And it was something that was frequently said to me when I quit and you know, said, hey, guys, I'm an alcoholic. Everyone was like, oh, well, you must have an addictive personality. So, you know, watch yourself for that exercise or that.
Sugar
or tea or, you know. So everyone was kind of watching me like a hawk to see what I would cross addict to. And cross addiction is common. But anyway, it is a myth, according to 3 out of 4 of my experts, all of which I asked each of these burning questions to, because I just wanted to know what all of them would say. So 3 out of 4 of them said addictive personality doesn't exist, because what is really interesting is that certain character traits that are opposing to one another predict later addiction. Things like anxiety and introversion, but also extroversion and being impulsive and spontaneous, things like that. So you can see that it would be the rare person that would possess both polarities of those personality traits. So there's obviously not just one singular addictive personality that is later going to go on and be very sticky for addictions. It's just not true.
That's of course not to say that we don't get the munchies for sugar in the early weeks, some of us, and you know, we do start doing other things, but that doesn't mean that that's going to happen forever. I think it's a case of, you know, as you said, I love the way you described the fact that, you're a toddler in those early weeks and months. You really are finding your feet. And of course, you're going to have extra time on your hands and not know what to do with yourself. And your chemical, you know, the neurochemicals are all over the shop. So of course, you're going to reach for sugar or whatever. But over time, and that's what's so lovely about, you know, your book, you're throwing this forward in time. So you're being really realistic about how things pan out when you feel just so much more stable. I think that's a word that so often comes up for me. I'm so much more stable than I was.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel safe. That's that was a key theme in the book, that I finally feel safe within myself and in my relationships and from alcohol. And it's just such a luxurious place to find myself.
Yeah, so there's a little section on boundaries, isn't there, which is great.
Yeah, boundaries. Oh my gosh. I don't know what your relationship's been like with boundaries.
Oh, but terrible in the past. Terrible.
Yeah. I literally only learned how to do them about 2 years ago.
I actually thought that setting boundaries meant you were just a really arsy person.
Yeah, me too. I would bitch about people who set boundaries with me. I'd be like, how dare they say no to my unreasonable request? How dare they not reply to my unsolicited email asking them for a favour? But the thing is, it's very common that people who don't have boundaries themselves. So I was very much the type that would pretty much do anything you asked me to do if you asked me to do it. They are the people who expect other people to say yes to everything. Mm. So it's the boundaryless who get irate when we set boundaries with them. Yeah. So I think that's important to remember, to have that compassion, because it's just that they're not there yet and they don't know what boundaries are and they don't know that they're healthy. Yeah. Now, when people say no to me, I literally feel like high-fiving them.
Yes.
Like, nice boundaries. And you can tell when somebody is a healthy, when they've really gone through this process and that they're healthy and secure and in all of this too, because they will respond to your no with, oh my God, absolutely no worries, you know.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd ask, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know that it's not damaged the relationship and they're not going away to have a bitching session about you because you said no.
Yeah, totally.
But it's so important in recovery or whatever you call it, in staying sober, I found, because if you don't set boundaries, you become cannibalized with resentment over time, because your energy and your day and your effort and your work schedule is not your own. You just give it to other people all the time. And so then you don't have enough time for yourself or time to rest or money or, you know, whatever it is that you need, because you're just giving it away all the time.
Yeah.
And obviously give away some of it, give away maybe half of it, you know, but keep enough for yourself.
Well, self-care is just the thing we have to learn, you know. I mean, I had no idea what it meant till I got sober. You know, self-care is like those, you know, rich women that go to spas and lunch the whole time. I had no idea what it meant. For me, my self-care was a glass of wine. So I had no idea what it really meant.
Oh my God, I really identify with that. And I wonder if it's something that the younger generations are just much more au fait with. They've often been parented in a way where a no isn't the worst thing you can say to a parent.
I think that's true.
Mm. Yeah, so I was definitely parented in the way that you did not say no to superior, you know, people in your family, and you did not say no to work colleagues either, because I was in a very competitive industry like you. Mm. So you just had to say yes to everything to A, get people to like you, continue to like you, and B, get ahead.
Yeah.
And so I carried this one way too far, and it's something that I still struggle with to this day.
If you've been listening carefully to the podcast over the last few months, you'll know that in addition to being trained in NLP and EFT, I have this year also trained in family constellations as a practitioner in family constellations. It's a massive topic. It's way too in-depth to try to explain in just a few sentences on a podcast. But all I can say is it's profound work. It's absolutely amazing, life-changing work. Most of you know that I've spoken about it lots of times, the way I really genuinely believe that family constellations made such a massive impact on my life. And in fact, I've been running some workshops. We have another one lined up on January the 23rd in Hertfordshire. And just around the time I was doing my training, I came across the fantastic book, It Didn't Start With You, by Mark Wolin. That book is all about inherited family trauma. I mean, this interview, I think, got more downloads than many interviews I've done. It's a topic that is just so fascinating. So I thought it'd be great to hear another clip with Mark.
So for anyone who really has not got any clue what we're talking about, can you define for us then what inherited family trauma is?
Well, let's say one of our parents or grandparents had a significant trauma. They lost their mother or their father when they were young, or our mother or father, they were sent away, they were raised by a relative, they were placed in an orphanage, or maybe one of their siblings died tragically when they were young. And an event like this can break the heart of the family, but the reaction to the trauma doesn't necessarily stop with the people who experienced it. For example, the feelings, the sensations, specifically the stress response, the way the genes express, this can pass forward to the children and the grandchildren, affecting them in a similar way, even though they didn't personally experience the trauma.
It's incredible, isn't it? And I know it's only in relatively recent years that we've sort of started talking about this whole field of epigenetics and what it really means. And I was really struck when I read your book, that when you explained something that I ought to have known, but I don't think I did know, that, you know, just explain to us how, you know, for a woman giving birth to a daughter, there's the grandmother's eggs in there as well.
Right. So when our grandmother is 5 months pregnant with our mother will have all the eggs. You know, the female cell line, the egg line, stops dividing in the fifth month of pregnancy. So all the eggs that our mother has and she'll ever have will be embedded in her womb while she's embedded in our grandmother's womb. And of course, one of those eggs in our mother's womb is then us.
Yeah.
So really, you know, you can look at in a way where three generations are sharing the same biological environment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, tell us how this is kind of based in science, this stuff, in scientific research.
Okay. So as infants, you know, we don't enter the world with a clean hard drive. You would think we do. They used to think we did. We entered the world that way. But to continue with this computer analogy, there seems to be an operating system already in place, one that contains the fallout from the traumas that our parents or grandparents experienced. And then here we are, born with fears and feelings that don't always belong to us. And when we look at the science, the trauma, a trauma in general, it changes us.
Yeah.
Literally, it causes a chemical change in our DNA. And this can change how our genes function, sometimes for generations. So technically, after this traumatic event, there'll be a chemical tag that attaches to our DNA and tells our cells to use or ignore certain genes so we can better deal with this trauma that just took place. And then the way our genes are affected changes how we act or feel. For example, we can become sensitive or reactive to situations that are similar to the original trauma, even if that trauma occurred in a past generation, so that we have a better chance of surviving it in this generation. Mm. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
If our grandparents came from a war-torn country, so let's say people are being shot or bombs are going off or uniformed men are lining people up in the square and people are being taken away, our grandparents would develop and pass forward a particular skill set designed to help them deal with that trauma. So let's say they would develop a skill set of sharper reflexes or quicker reaction times or reactions to the violence they experienced or the violence they witnessed to help them survive this trauma. Well, that's what they're in essence passing forward. Now, the problem is here we are in the next generation inheriting a stress response with the dials set to 10, prepared for this war, prepared for this catastrophe that never arrives. And we rarely make the link that our anxiety, our hypervigilance, our depression, our addiction response is connected to our parents and our grandparents. We just think we're wired this way.
Yeah. Yeah. We just think that's how we are. So if it is something that interests you, please go to thesoberclub.com/events and have a look there at the Family Constellations Day that we're holding in Hertfordshire on Sunday, 23rd of January. I'm working with an expert who's been doing this stuff for 30 years because I'm still a newbie, but he's really skilled. Ralph Nguyen is my co-host for that event, Sunday, 23rd of January. See if you can make it. Have a look at some of the testimonials before you make your decision and just see if it resonates with you. I really believe that it should be available on the NHS, if truth be told. We've kept our ticket price quite low. So have a look and see whether that's something that you can make, or if you're interested in one for the future. And we'll set some more dates up. Now, if you saw my posts about my 4 years of sobriety, you'll know, and if you've listened to podcasts, you'll know that I credit the wonderful Claire Pooley with helping me finally have my last day one. I was handed the book to read, The Sober Diaries, because we were going to be interviewing Claire on Radio 2. And it was just before Christmas. And I just knew, I looked at the title and I knew. And I did finish the book on December the 30th, 2017. And that was that. So I can honestly say that book changed my life. And I'm, you know, eternally grateful to Claire. And it's absolutely one of the reasons I wanted to write my book, because I reckon if my book can help one person, then, you know, that's an amazing thing. And of course, most of you know that in Happy, Healthy, Sober, I wanted to include lots of other experts as well and masses of stuff around health and well-being. So when the book came out last March, I thought rather than just talk at you about my own book, I'd ask somebody else to do the job. So we've got something a little bit different for you today, because I thought that as my book had come out, I didn't want to just kind of talk at everybody. So I thought it'd be quite nice to have a chat with another interviewer who can kind of fire some questions at me. So I'm so thrilled, Pam, that you've agreed to do this. Pam Francis is a celebrity interviewer of, goodness, been doing it for 30 years or something, haven't you, Pam?
Many.
You've been doing it for a good few years. So I'm terribly sorry that we can't meet in a lovely hotel and I can pretend to be a celeb. but I really appreciate you being willing to ask me some questions. Just before we do that, you're going to have to share a couple of celeb stories of some of the famous, amazing people you've interviewed.
Oh, my goodness. Where do I start? Well, I think people always ask me who my favourites are. And I think it has to be Joanna Lumley.
Yeah, she is lovely, isn't she? I've met her.
Adorable. Mm. And she makes everybody that she meets feel like the most important person
she does.
In her world.
She does. It's so true. True. Yeah.
Lots and lots of others. I mean, Joan Collins, the Duchess of York, the wonderful Barbara Windsor.
She was lovely, wasn't she?
I get to do things like go on set of TV shows being made, like Downton Abbey.
Oh, that must be fun.
Years ago, and Coronation Street. And so, yeah, over the years, I've interviewed many, many. Mm. And, yeah, my favourite is Joanna.
Mm. Yeah, lovely. Perfect. Okay, well, you got little me so far away.
I will. Well, first of all, Janie, congratulations.
Thank you. I do appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Pam. I mean, we should say we know each other because you're also, you know, have had your own little sober journey. So you might want to share little bits of that as well, you know.
Oh, sure. Well, it was because I read that you were writing a book that I did a little bit of research, and I thought, oh, I think I want to interview Janie about this because it's an interesting story. Mm. I know your book is actually part of a huge growing genre of books called Quitlet, which tackle the subject of giving up alcohol, and lots of them are memoirs about rock bottoms and terrible journeys to sobriety. But yours is not like that. I've read it and it certainly isn't. So who have you written this book for, Janie?
Mm. Well, I often say, and I'm sure I've said it in the book, I can't actually remember, it was my lockdown project, but of course you can't remember everything you've written. But I guess that I would have said what I said in my TEDx talk, which is that I believe that certainly in the UK, we've all been brainwashed into thinking that there are two types of drinkers. There are those at rock bottom who clearly need alcohol services and rehabilitation. And you know, I was not in that position at all. I didn't identify with that in any way. And then there's everyone else, and everyone else is perfectly okay. And I wasn't that either. I was waking up really very unhappy with the life I was living and who I was becoming. So I was what we now know, the term is grey area drinker. I was a grey area drinker. I wasn't dependent, but I wasn't okay either. And I have written the book for grey area drinkers, for those people who are not clinically dependent and at rock bottom, but they're not 100% okay. And how much they're drinking, in a way, doesn't matter, because it's this question that I want people to ask themselves, which is, could my life be better physically and emotionally without the booze? And if the answer to that is yes, then, you know, that's who I've written the book for. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk more about it, but of course, the book, I've written the book for people who are sober curious and day one grey area drinkers, but also for people who've been sober for years, because of course it's all the health and well-being stuff as well.
Yes, and I mean the term grey area drinking was very new to me, and I'm sure it will still be new to quite a few people. Mm-hmm. But I resonated with it as soon as I heard it, and I just wondered, as well as you coach as well, don't you? You coach one to one people who are grey area drinkers. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I first came across this term, as most people did, I think, when Jolene Park was the person who coined it. You know, Jolene is very well known coach in the States, and she spoke about grey area drinking. She did a TEDx talk and came up with this kind of concept, if you like, and really identified that grey area drinkers are often people who can stop. You know, they have stopped. Most grey area drinkers will say to you, well, I know I'm not addicted. I know I'm not clinically dependent because I stopped when I had my children, or I stopped for a month, you know, a couple of years ago, or I stopped for a week, or, you know, a whole range of ways of expressing why they aren't dependent, because they aren't. But nevertheless, they're caught in this trap. And I then used the term in my TEDx talk, you know, and I said, it's a spectrum, and there are many, many different shades of grey, and none of them sexy. Because I do believe that, you know, it is a spectrum of different shades of grey. But I genuinely believe that we need to step off the booze elevator before it hits the bottom, you know. So yeah, that's my understanding of grey area drinking. And then I trained to become a grey area drinking recovery coach, which a lot of the training was to add to the sort of health coaching I already did. I'm already a EFT practitioner and an NLP, and I wanted to add this piece in because it focuses a lot on the kind of brain chemistry. And I think it's the brain chemistry piece that really has to be looked at and that often gets forgotten about, actually. So thank you to Pam Francis, who has just celebrated 1 year sober herself. I think I'm right in saying. Amazing. Pam's a sober club member. And it's just been fantastic to watch her blossom and change as the year has gone on. Happy, Healthy, Sober, Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life is out as an audiobook now. Wow, how long did that take? It took forever, but it's finally out as an audiobook. So I hope you enjoy it. If you pick that up and you're able to leave me a nice review, I'd really appreciate it. So just a reminder then, the Family Constellations event is January the 23rd. We've got a Champneys self-care and sobriety retreat next weekend, January the 8th and 9th in Hertfordshire as well, Champneys Tring. There is still some space if you fancy that last minute, fancy treating yourself last minute. So just check out the events page at the Sober Club. And obviously, if you want support, if you want connection, just check it out. It's very low cost. You've got absolutely nothing to lose. A few quid, literally. It'd be an awful lot less than you spent on booze, probably even in one night. And if you're thinking of doing this thing, just do it. There's so much support. You don't have to join the Sober Club. There are loads of other ways of getting the support and connection you need. But whatever you do, reach out and tell someone. Don't do this on your own. Don't do what I did, which is tell no one. Literally tell no one. Try and hide it. Felt such a sense of shame that I tried to keep it secret. Nonsense. You know, it's an amazing, brave thing you're doing. So go for it. Share it with someone. You're very welcome to tell me. Just message me. You can follow me on social media. Drop me a message and just get yourself connected. And I wish you such a happy, healthy, optimistic, amazing new year. Let's not forget to just raise our vibration and bring in the light. And I'll see you next year. I can honestly say that this time. See you next year. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.